On this week's episode of The Freenoter, we'll look at how to get speaking gigs and the fine art of speaking proposals.
We'll also look at the work of this week's real hero of speaking, Phil M. Jones, and learn exactly what to say.
And we'll celebrate the dawn of flight with a classic cocktail called The Aviation.
All that on this week's edition of The Freenoter.
Well, welcome to episode 3 of The Freenoter, and this one is a little bit different than the previous ones because just as circumstances dictate sometimes, we're apart, Tamsin.
I know. Sad.
What's wrong with the world?
Well, I'm just living the life of a freenoter, in this case, a T&E noter, because that is literally what I'm doing here in beautiful Dallas, Texas.
Yes. Sadly, we are apart this episode. So the craft cocktail of the week that we will talk about later will have to be enjoyed separately, which brings me no end of sadness, I have to say.
You're telling me.
So we're going to talk this week about how to get the gigs. And this is a really key thing for freenoters because you can't become a good freenoter until you get reps, and you can't get reps if you don't get the gigs. And the way that freenoters get gigs is a lot different than the way paid professional speakers get gigs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, by the time you're a paid professional speaker, many times people are coming to you and saying, hey, will you keynote this event? We're going to pay you some money and let's come do this. But with a freenoter, it's largely outbound in the beginning, I would say, though I think you and I have both gotten to the point where with certain conferences, people will now ask us to come, but it's still as a freenote. But yeah, I think it's the difference between inbound and outbound, and freenoting is definitely outbound.
Yeah, you've got to kind of do the work. And as much as freenoting is a great, quote unquote, inbound sales technique, and again, that's, you know, something that I've been doing for years and years and years, right? You give a speech, someone contacts you after, and then they write you the check for whatever it is you're selling. And that's, you know, I assume it's more complicated than that, but that's that's kind of how it works. But the ironic thing about freenoting as a, you know, thought leadership driven inbound sales strategy, it requires a lot of outbound work at the outset. I think that's what you're referring to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because typically what we're talking about are conferences that have calls for proposals or speaker submissions or talk submissions or any of the kinds of those things that typically open anywhere from 6-9 months ahead of the event itself. And speakers are expected or asked to draft a proposal, usually something fairly short and to the point that basically says what is it they'd speak on. And then there's a giant process on the other side to analyze all those proposals, which, being a former conference organizer and having sat on those program committees, that's a doozy of a job to have to sift through all those proposals.
Yeah. And I feel like I wrote really lousy proposals early in my career. Like I wrote them like I was writing a term paper for Professor Fixler at Tufts. And I was not writing them to actually have a human say, oh, I want him to speak at my conference. He sounds interesting. That's not how I wrote them. Mm. My early proposals were very much focused on, here's the crap I have to say.
Yeah.
This is what I need to say to drive business. This is our new product, or this is a service that we offer. And it was not really written from the standpoint of what an audience would want to hear necessarily. And I think, you know, I assumed that the audience would want to hear me because I'm awesome. And
that well, I want to hear you because you're awesome, babe. But yeah, generally, conference organizers that they want to hear, they want to see something that they think their attendees will think is awesome. And so the mistake that you're talking about is absolutely one that I saw over and over again. You know, when I was on program committees, it certainly was something I saw when I was, you know, on the front lines of receiving TEDx speaker proposals. But people really fall in love with how they want to talk about their idea and forget that the person on the other end knows nothing about the idea, and they're looking for things that fill gaps in what their attendees have and what questions their attendees have and gaps in their attendees' knowledge.
Yeah. And just two quick things about this. Number one, we are talking about writing lots and lots of proposals for calls for speakers at conferences. And that's that's kind of the bread and butter of how you're going to get into Freenode is by writing these proposals. And we're going to talk in a moment about how to make them more compelling. But the other thing to remember here is that conference organizers are humans, and they are humans with a job, and they have a job that they don't want to get fired from and that they get evaluated for. And so every speaker that they allow into the conference reflects upon them in some fashion or form. And I know you and I have both gotten, you know, all kinds of different hoops to jump through from conference organizers, you know, send us your slides. Can we review your slides? Make sure you use this template, all this other kind of stuff. But it all comes down to their desire to not get fired, right? To do a good job, because their job is to put on a good conference and there are evaluations for that sort of thing. And so all of that has to be in the back of your mind.
Yeah. I mean, it's this delicate balance, and it's one that you certainly hear speakers talk about amongst themselves, about like, well, you know, they can't put this conference on without our content. So, you know, they should be grateful. And it's like, yeah. And you wouldn't have an opportunity to have those inbound connections with these people if they didn't have the conference. So we kind of all need to find a way to play together. But the point that you bring up is really important, is that, you know, their job is to satisfy the needs of their clients, which in most cases is either the paying attendees or, you know, their company's folks that are coming in. Like, that's who they have to satisfy. And those people, by and large, are probably not looking for your new idea or your new product. Like I said before, they are looking for answers to questions that they currently have. And so I think, you know, as you're thinking through, you know, all these conference proposals and starting to think through what would I present, one of the first places to start is with what questions is a potential audience asking that your idea could help answer. And that can be just a really important place to start thinking about how to frame your idea. And let me make this point because it's important. It doesn't mean that you're shape-shifting your idea to fit. You're just figuring out how do you start from where they are and connect to whatever your topic is.
Yeah, that's a really, really key point. And that's, you know, we talked in the last episode about how you and I both early on in our speaking careers spoke at a conference called Blog World and Blog World New Media Expo, and it had a variety of names, but it was really about blogs and social media and things like that. And, you know, on the one hand, that's kind of not my job. That's not what I do day to day. I'm a consumer insights person, but there was absolutely a social media angle back then on what I talked about. And so in order to get accepted, to get gigs at these events, I couldn't lead with, hey, I want you all to buy a survey, because that's not going to fly. I had to lead with something that was going to be useful to that particular audience. And really, it's exactly like applying for a job. The best practice is not to use a standard cover letter and resume. It's to completely customize that cover letter and resume for the job that you want. And the job that you want is to speak at that conference.
100%. It means, I think, a lot of times, not necessarily. Well, here's the thing: the trap of the freenoter is to invent a whole new talk for each conference and each variety of conference over the course of the year, and that way lies tears and exhaustion.
Guilty.
However, it's also a really good way to kind of build up your talk building chops. But ultimately, what I recommend when I'm working with folks on this is find your core talk, at least for the year, and then find the different ways, as you're talking about, to kind of wrap it in and customize the language you're using for it for the particular conference that you're submitting it to.
So one thing that I think you really need to do as a freenoter, and again, you really have to have a beginner's mind here. You can't just assume, as we all, I think, are want to do as a default, that we have this great thing that people want to hear. And why wouldn't you want me on your, why wouldn't you want me? Why aren't you calling me now? Because I'm very special. But, but, you know, people don't know you. And, you know, so one of the things that I might have learned this from Chris Penn, actually, who will at some point crop up as a real hero of speaking on this show, just to keep running Google searches, Google alerts, basically, for, you know, call for speakers, call for proposals, become versed in the conferences that serve the people that you want to serve. And begin to steep yourselves in their lingo, begin to steep yourselves in, you know, look at past conferences that have served these communities before and look at the topics that have already been accepted, right? You have this huge body of history in some cases with some conferences about what has already been accepted. And so you can begin to kind of, you know, steep yourselves in what the kinds of things that the attendees are wanting and that what's already been successful. So, Tamsin, you're not only a speaker, you've been a conference organizer, and you've seen a lot of successful submissions. You've seen some unsuccessful submissions. And I know that you've taken a lot of that into account and you know, kind of learned from all that. And you put out a great video, actually, on how to do a great conference submission. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But why don't you, if you would, just walk us through some of the things that you've learned as a conference organizer and how you have adapted them into being a speaker in crafting successful conference submissions.
Sure. And that video was really an update of an article I'd written on LinkedIn kind of a couple years previously, that, as you say, just combined what I knew worked as a speaker with what I saw didn't work as a conference organizer, as somebody reviewing submissions. And so, I mean, the key things are, what I decided was that there's always certain pieces of information that description, that proposal always needs to have. One is that problem that your talk will solve for the audience. And this can't be like a hidden, like proprietary product talk kind of thing, like we were talking about before. It needs to be a problem they would readily agree they have, or a question they are readily agree they are asking right now. So, and you need to identify that piece first. And then typically I suggest opening with something like that. So for instance, if I'm, you know, if I'm writing, like I just wrote one the other day for one of my own conferences, a speaker conference from the National Speakers Association. This is definitely a free note. And this is not even to get any clients because they don't help people with this. But it's about making slides that stick. And so, what I'm opening with is, you know, a line that says, you know, conventional wisdom says people remember pictures better than words. It's why so many speakers use slides. Yet, depending on what's on those slides, they can actually work against you. So I'm starting with something that people already know they want, right? And so sometimes you can put that right in the title. In this case, I'm titling this particular talk Slides That Stick, using neuroscience to make your talk more memorable. So with right there in the title of the talk, I've given that goal. I've given that thing that the audience is likely to look for. They're using slides. They want slides that are going to make their talk more memorable. They're going to want slides that work with their talk in a very specific way. So the first thing is figure out what that is. I call that the goal. The second thing is to know kind of what is the kind of new, previously unknown problem that your talk is going to address. So here's the thing. Everybody knows they have a problem. That's the goal. Like if that's the question they're asking, they know they have that. And in order to make your talk interesting and sound like something they haven't heard before, people want to hear, they want to read in that description some new piece of information, not a new piece of the solution necessarily, because before they're ready to hear that, they need to hear a new piece of the problem. So in the description I was just talking about, you know, that's what I am doing when I'm introducing, yet depending on what's on those slides, they can actually work against you. They can hurt not just the memorability of your message, but your brand as well. So those are now two things you need. What is the question that you're going to solve for your audience? And then second, what's the kind of angle on what's getting in the way of that question that you're going to approach? The third thing you need to know before you write a description is some level of what's the high level kind of change in thinking or behavior, or the kind of core idea that you're going to be introducing in the talk. That's usually where I like to kind of go next. In this case, the answer was in my case to kind of build with the brain in mind, to kind of build slides in line with neuroscience, not as notes. And so the way I put that in the presentation and this description was, so how can you make sure your slides work for you instead? Build them with the brain and your brand in mind. So now those three things: goal, problem, kind of some allusion to the idea that you're kind of core concept that you're introducing or the core shift that you're arguing for. And then the next thing to have kind of ready in hand is kind of what I like to call outcomes and authority. In other words, what are some pieces about you that are going to be relevant to introduce as a speaker of that topic? So I'm a big believer in including some information about you, the speaker, in your description, because a lot of times this is all your conference proposal, you know, your conference submission reviewers are looking at, right? So they may not look at your bio. So it's kind of important to kind of weave something in there. So in this case, you know, I thought it was most relevant that I'm a branded message strategist. I'm a speaker. And I think it's important for this particular audience of fellow speakers. They know that I build my own slides. So the way I introduced that was that in this hands-on session, branded message strategist, speaker, and self-slide builder Tamsin Webster will teach you. And then here are the outcomes. Her process for building slides that make your message and you as memorable as they can be. So those are kind of those pieces. And the video and the LinkedIn article that we'll link to have those pieces and kind of how they put together. So that's kind of the core. And then, and we can talk about this separately, then there's this question of how do you answer the actionable takeaways? But let me pause there because I feel like I just had a little speech.
One of the things that I love about your approach is that just from my exposure to things like NSA and speaking conferences for speakers, something like slides is kind of, it's, you know, I don't want to say it's catnip, but I'm going to say it's catnip because I think, you know, people feel in that business, like slides can be really impactful and everybody always feels like they can do better. And so it's a thing that they are seeking. You are not a slide designer, right?
No.
You like, that's not what you do. What you have done is you have taken your process and adapted it to slides in a way that is not incongruent with who you are and your message, but it's more adaptable to what it is that people are seeking. And that's the kind of adaptation that I think is required when you're going to submit to a conference, especially a conference that's maybe, you know, on the peripheries of your interest level or of your potential customer base, something that's, you know, maybe not necessarily in your wheelhouse. You're the one that has to do the adapting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the thing to note here is that you actually have to know a fair amount about your talk before you write the description. And I don't think you have to have your actual talk built before you write the description, but you kind of have to have at least a core outline of it. Like I said, you need to know what's the question you're going to answer. You need to know what's the kind of previously unknown problem you're going to introduce. You need to know kind of what's the core of what I call the truth, the kind of this core concept upon which everything hangs. You need to know what's the high level shift in thinking or behavior. And you need to have thought through what are some of the actions that you're going to give people to talk about. The reason why I say you have to have all this is because, and totally, I have been there. I'm sure you have too. Is that in my early days of freenoting, I'd write these beautiful descriptions, right? Without having written the talk, by the way. And then they'd get accepted. And then I'd be like, oh, crap.
Then you gotta write the thing.
Oh, you start writing it. You're like, what was I thinking? You're like, that was a good 5 minutes what I just described in that description, but that won't actually be a whole talk. Or you do the opposite and you write a description that is way more than you could possibly cover in usually the 30 or 45 minute slot that you're given. And so this is why I think it's really important. Like, again, you don't have to know the whole talk, but you have to know some of those core pieces so that you can write a description that, you know, for me, what I've done is that it allows me, you know, 6 months later when something is accepted, I can go back and because I've used those pieces in a very specific way, I can go back and extract from my write-up what was that core outline that I was planning on. And so that I find is just very useful. So, I mean, basically the way it all works together is that you can open a description with that goal. You contrast that goal with the problem you've identified, you kind of allude to the core concept or to the big change that you're recommending. You kind of match the outcomes to authority. And then for the ones that ask for it, and increasingly all of them ask for it, that you kind of list what they'll learn. You kind of these takeaways or the, you know, actionable concepts or whatever. And there's a special art to those too.
Writing speaker proposals and, you know, call for submissions and things like that, that's going to be the bread and butter of the freenoter. And so getting good at that is going to be over 50% of what you do to get the gigs. But I also want to bring up a couple of other options here. And to varying degrees, you and I have done all three of these. So there's three other things I want to bring up here as other potential avenues. And I'll kind of go in order from lowest bar, or, you know, lowest barrier of entry to highest barrier of entry. And the first one is to just is to have your own virtual event.
Yeah.
If you can't get a gig, make a gig, make a gig online. And just personally speaking with Edison, that's something that we have done for years and years and years. And our, you know, our annual Infinite Dial webinar is in fact a virtual event, and it's not going to happen overnight, but why not start now? You start from somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And so why not start from now? And you know, for us, I think it took, you know, it really did, I think, take 10 years for it to really completely stick. But once it did, it became just, frankly, a business machine for us. So
absolutely.
And a lot of that's consistency. But having that kind of annual webinar or some kind of regular virtual event that you completely control, and maybe the first time you do it, three people sign up. But that's a 30-minute conversation that you get to have with three people. A salesperson gets to have that with one. In that. So there's nothing, you know, there's no downside to it.
No. And I think physical events are a great option as well. I mean, I think my origin story for becoming a freenoter happened. I think I mentioned this on the first episode.
You were bitten by a radioactive spider.
That's right. No. But this was an event that the freenoter themselves had created. And so, you know, just kind of rented a room in a hotel and, like, you know, got the word out, and that's how they did it. And so, I mean, particularly if you're doing this on behalf of your business, you probably have your client lists and those kinds of things. I know some of the work that I do is like, the kind of freenoting I still will do is I often will do lunch and learns. I particularly do that for agencies, particularly in the Boston area, where I'll go in, I'll do a lunch and learn, I'll describe kind of my basic process that I generally talk about. And yes, absolutely, that is designed to get more business. But you know, that's in essence I'm creating my own event. When it's a lunch and learn, you're doing it at the site of somebody else, but that's a way to get out there and to start getting people, A, get your reps, get on your feet, and B, it's a nice direct way oftentimes to lead into business.
The next thing that we have done that has worked really well for us, and a lot of conferences kind of require this. Like, a lot of conferences, they will not let you just come in as a vendor. If you come in as a vendor, they'll want you to buy a space, basically. And
oh yeah,
and we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But if you are not prepared to do that, one way to get into those kinds of conferences is to come in with a case study that involves a client.
Yeah.
And if you can co-present something, and this is how I first got on the stage at one of the big conferences in my business as a market researcher is the Advertising Research Foundation. And they just don't let you on stage as a vendor. They don't.
Yeah. Same thing was true at CASE, the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, which is where I was on the program committee for a couple of years. And same thing, like, vendors, no matter whether you were a company or a single person, you literally couldn't submit unless you were going in with a client.
The only way to get on stage is to have a case study that is supported by a big client. And if you have a client that is willing to co-submit with you, and, you know, you might have to pay their travel, make it easy for them, do all the heavy lifting, do everything you can to get that client on stage with you and make it easy for them. But if you can do that, like having a two-person case study with a client and a vendor on stage, conferences love that. So the third way, I think, that you can get the gigs as a freenoter, and it has to be said, is to buy your way onto stage.
Like, yep.
Yeah, 100%. And I've, you know, and frankly, I've done that. I've done that in a couple of different ways.
Well, not personally.
No, you're right. I have not done that personally, but I have worked with clients for whom, you know, I've spoken at CES, for example, the Consumer Electronics Show. That's a good gig. That's a great gig.
Very good. Yeah.
And, you know, both of the times that I've spoken there, they've been with one of our clients that essentially paid for that spot on stage. We have done some things to help with that and with the kind of the research that we've provided. Sometimes you just have to. And if it's an audience that you really want to get in front of, and you're not getting the opportunity, let's say organically from a call to proposals or something like that, then it's a thing you have to weigh. And I will say it's a thing that I've certainly been involved with a number of times, that it's if it's the right people to talk to and it's the only way to get in front of them, then you have to consider it.
But from the conversations I've had with conference organizers and some of these folks that are that run the conferences themselves, I mean, they know that those pay to play slots are necessary, and they live in mortal fear of what the vendors will do and say in those. So, know that if you can go in there and be a great freenoter, meaning you can go in there and even though you have paid your way onto the stage, that you deliver something that is generous and not selling and useful to people, not only will the audience love you, but the conference organizer will as well. And they're going to probably do things for you, like make sure you have great slots in future conferences, those kinds of things. So just know that just because you've paid does not give you the right to start to sell. It just doesn't. I mean, it just comes back to kind of that cardinal rule of freenoting. You have to be as useful or more useful to the audience than they are to you.
Well, this brings up, I think, a great way to end this segment, which is with reader mail.
Reader mail.
We have reader mail, and we'd love to hear from you. And if you have some things that you want us to cover or talk about or questions.
Wait, people are reading the podcast? I'm sorry.
It's a thing I've invented called the Readcast.
And this is one of my favorite viewer/listeners who wrote it.
Oh, yes. And so this is Kathy McPhillips, who works at the Content Marketing Institute and Content Marketing World, which is a place that you and I have both freenoted for years and years and years.
Yes.
And she wrote us with a question. And if you have questions, by the way, you can write us at thefreenoter@gmail.com.
Yes,
the
you
freenoter
can.
thefreenoter@gmail.com. And Tamsin will answer every one of those. I don't. Because I can't write, really. Or read. So Kathy McPhillips sent us a message, and she asked us a pretty great question, and I know you have a take on this. So
yeah. Yes. So she sent us this. She said, unsolicited topic idea for your podcast, which we are always open to, by the way. She let me phrase it as a question. She's asking, are founders and CEOs always the best people on stage to represent the company in a sponsored session, especially the ones that struggle on stage? So clearly we've been setting this up in such a way to say that, oh, no. I mean, I think that it's really, really important to think through, as Kathy pointed out to us, how important it is to get, sometimes gently and sometimes not, get your CEO or founder to kind of swallow their pride in favor of putting the best or most engaging team member up there. And I get it. That is not an easy conversation to have, particularly if you've got a CEO or a founder who's like, I'm the one that talks about us the best, even though I hate to be on stage.
I am the one.
But it really is important that you've got somebody who isn't just a subject matter expert for what you're talking about, but somebody who can actually go with that kind of giving mindset to the audience and actually has some kind of comfort and excitement to be on stage. But here's the secret. I have yet to be at a company that doesn't have at least one person, and usually there's multiple people, who actually are kind of excited about that opportunity to be out there and be a face and a voice of the company. So Kathy's question, no, CEOs and founders are not always the best people to be on there with a sponsored session. You know, my opinion is that you really want somebody who, yes, is knowledgeable at the topic. That's terrible. You don't want someone going up there and going, I have no idea what I'm talking about here, but they sent me out there because I'm cute. But you do want somebody who can really kind of connect with the audience.
Yeah, I think you need filters, people with the ability to bridge from one thing to another. And sometimes founders and CEOs have that ability. And sometimes they're just, you know, they're so passionate about their idea that they proselytize, but that's not what people go to a conference for.
No, I mean, and it makes sense. It really does. I mean, you know, the founder, the CEO, they are in many ways the expert in the topic or the idea that was behind the product or the service. But the problem is that that expertise is actually getting in their way. It's a known cognitive bias. You and I both know it. We probably have already talked about it, called the curse of knowledge, which is that thing where once you know a thing, it's impossible for you to imagine what it was like to not know that thing.
You know who does know a thing?
Who knows a thing?
I'm going to tell you who knows a thing. Our friend, this week's real hero of speaking, Phil Jones.
Absolutely. Phil M. Jones.
Phil M. Jones, not to be confused with the other initials of Phil Jones's. we've known Phil for really just a couple of years now. But he is a very, very persuasive speaker. And we wanted to spotlight him this week because, you know, part of getting the gigs, as we mentioned at the very beginning of this show, even though a speech is an inbound thing for your company, there's a lot of outbound work that goes into it. And Phil's kind of a genius at outbound.
He absolutely is. And like we were saying earlier, he really got much of his start with self-hosted events. And what's really interesting is that, you know, you mentioned that we've only known him for a couple of years. But in those couple of years, what he's done is essentially rebuilt from scratch a speaking business that was very successful over in the UK, and then rebuilt it from scratch here in the US, following a lot of the same things that he did over in the UK. So, I mean, it's actually a mark of his ability to do what he talks to people about, which he does speak about influence and persuasion as it applies to sales or all sorts of related topics. But his ability to do that is remarkable. And like I said, much of that started with him hosting his own events and getting the reps and figuring out what worked for his audiences and, critically, how to customize those audiences. Because there's really very few people as good as Phil at reshaping his content around an audience and around the topics that they particularly like.
I know that when I started my freenoting career, it was to sort of get away from what I thought being a salesperson, but you're always in sales. You're always in the process of selling your ideas to somebody. And I learned a lot from Phil about just how to be intentional about that and still be congruent with who I am.
He will, because he's gotten these kind of frameworks and these bits that work so well, he can kind of exchange in and out different audience examples. So for instance, if he's talking about a sales conversation, he can talk about it in using the language that a real estate agent would use. What are those kinds of conversations? And he will use those examples in that bit when he's talking to real estate people. And if he's talking to dentists, he will, in the same bit, he will now, you know, where he was talking about real estate questions, now he's flipping in, you know, dentist questions. I don't know. But I just think that's a really brilliant way to do it, is to kind of hold a basic framework, but then be able to kind of sub in your examples in a way that mimics and speaks to the audience that you're in front of.
Let's really drill down on the.
Oh, no.
No. You married me, though.
I did.
Do you know why you married me?
You've got good hair?
I'd like to think so. But it's because of my craft cocktail wizardry. This week, because you're in Dallas and I'm in Boston, and that's not what either one of us wanted. Let's be fair about that.
No.
No. We are apart, and we are apart because of the
winter storm.
Yes, we need to name it. So we're going to call it Winter Storm Freedom.
That is a terrible name for a storm.
I know, but we're going to stick with it, and it will last for eternity. Because of Winter Storm Freenoter, you are in Dallas and I am in Boston, and I miss you. And because I miss you so much, I'm making one of our favorite drinks, and in honor of the fact that it is commercial aviation that has separated us, it is a drink called the Aviation, which was first designed to celebrate the dawn of flight, as in Wilbur and Orville, not the, you know, the founding of Southwest. this is a pre-prohibition cocktail, and it was indeed designed to celebrate the dawn of flight, and it's got a very distinctive blue tinge to it, which is meant to replicate the blue of the sky. But It's one of our favorite cocktails, and it's a wonderful summer cocktail as well.
Yeah, and it's very much kind of in a type with last week's cocktail, The Last Word. So you kind of enjoyed that slightly sweet, slightly sour, slightly bitter combination, then the Aviation is definitely in that same family. So, and if you didn't like last week's, maybe you'll like this one. And if you don't, we'll switch to a different kind of cocktail next week, we promise.
Yes, next week is a brown drink, we promise, because we've done a couple weeks here of the nearly see-throughs, the gin drinks. And there's two different ways to make it. There's the proper Aviation cocktail way, and then there's the way that you and I make it, which is, it's neither right or wrong. It just makes it a kind of a different drink. So the original Aviation is, two parts gin. And again, we use, Plymouth for that, a quarter ounce of Luxardo, which was featured in last week's cocktail, The Last Word. It ends kind of a, it lends a roundness to the taste, a quarter ounce of creme de violette, which gives it the blue color. And a half ounce of lemon juice. And it's a lovely drink.
Fresh squeezed, please.
Yes. Yeah. Don't, don't buy the stuff that's in the little like plastic
lemon,
the little plastic lemon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I will share with you the way that, Tamsin and I make it, especially in the summer, which is a bit more of a gin sour. It's a little bit more refreshing, a little less alcoholic, and it's a super easy ratio, especially if you're making two. If you're making two, it's 4-3-2-1. It's 4 ounces of gin, 3 ounces of lemon juice, 2 ounces of Luxardo, and 1 ounce of creme de violette. And you can have all of those if you're just making it for one. Shake that up and serve it. We serve it in a coupe with a Luxardo cherry. And it has a delightful sky blue tinge to it, a freshness, a sourness, a little bit of roundness from the Luxardo. And like Wilbur and Orville, it will help you fly.
Which is the style we had it with the first time we had it. I think it was Tom Colicchio.
Yes.
Restaurant. And yeah. They made it like extra sour like that. And we spent some time, I should say you spent some time trying to reproduce it.
I did. I made over 4,000 different Aviations and drank them all over the course of a weekend, and I nailed it. And it's not a sweet drink. It's of the class of gin sours. So yep. It's delightful.
And as you'd expect, that little bit of violette, I mean, that's for the violet flower. And so it is a bit of a, it has a slight floral note to it. So expect that. Sometimes people are like, wait, what? What is that? But it's part of what I think is so delicious about it.
You know what else is delicious?
What's delicious?
You are my love.
Oh, that's sweet.
It's been a great show.
It has been.
And I think it's time to wind it up. On next week's episode of The Freenoter, we'll get clarity on the goal of a freenote and the three types of talks you can give.
We'll also pay tribute to one of the original gangsters of speaking.
And since we're in the middle of our first snowfall here in Boston, a cocktail.
Oh, you are.
Yes, I know. You dodged it. A cocktail to celebrate winter.
All that and more next week on The Freenoter. Cheers.
Cheers.